It was a couple of weeks ago when a friend of mine shared with me the story about the day a power failure took place at his house. It was early in the morning, somewhere around 6 o'clock, when a driver lost control of his car going around the nearby curve. It was one of those fall days where the streets were overly wet and the leaves had piled up to create this little sheen. And when the driver went off the road and crashed into the telephone pole, he hit the one that housed the transformer that fed electricity to the entire neighborhood. And while the driver walked away unscathed, he essentially pulled the plug on all the electricity for the homes running up and down the street. Adults woke up late for work and rushed and scrambled to get ready. Kids rushed around to avoid missing the school bus, because the alarm clock slept in and the automatic coffee makers didn't drip. The refrigerators just chilled out. Now, my friend works from his home office 2 weeks a month and goes to the main office for the other two. And on this particular day, he was working at home. He'd gotten up early and was already checking his email when the power went out. All of a sudden, everything just ground to a halt. There was no more phone or email. There was no fax machine. There was no video conferencing. There were no any talking heads in the background on TV debating the pros and cons of impeachment. So he went to the kitchen to scramble some eggs, but the auto igniter on the stove wouldn't work. And then he went to get something from his car in the garage, but the garage door opener wouldn't cooperate. And you know what happens. Every time he walked into the room, he'd flip on the light switch, completely in vain. But the worst part of the experience, he said to me, was that cold sense of silence. There were no humming appliances in the background, no radio to give off this stream of gentle white noise. And all day long, he said, he just sort of fumbled around not knowing what to do, feeling pretty useless. And so by the time his wife got home, they just sat around the kitchen table by candlelight, talking and wondering when the power would come back on. And then sometime around 8 or 8:30, they decided to just throw in the towel and go to bed. What else was there to do? But then around 2 a.m., something happened. Everything suddenly sprang to life. Lights flipped on all around the house. The TV began blaring from the living room downstairs. He heard his work computer boot up in the office, and his wife's hairdryer joined in this great electrical chorus. The refrigerator coughed and sputtered to life, and the alarm clocks everywhere started blinking. And so after going room to room, shutting everything down, he finally went back to bed. But the next morning, he said, he began to wonder if that power failure had actually been a good thing. And that's when he said, we often forget how much power is so pervasive in our lives. We often forget that it's everywhere. Now, one of the things that is part of the true meaning of Christmas is that when Jesus came into the world, he came to cut the power. And I'm not talking about electricity, but I'm talking about the very real power that people wield in our world. We know that there are people who exert power over other people by virtue of their wealth or position, by their status or their title. And we know that there's a very real power that people can use and sometimes even abuse in order to intimidate and manipulate other people into getting them to do what they want. And this kind of coercive power always tends to strike fear into people's hearts, especially when they're under the subject of that person. And so these are the people that Jesus came to pull the plug on. He came to cut the power in these kinds of situations. But what makes Jesus' way very different is that it's a rather subversive way. Now, among the four Gospels, only Matthew and Luke tell the story of Jesus' birth. They tell it in different ways with different elements of the story because they're writing to two different communities. But they both agree on this one fundamental insight. While the rest of the world is waiting around for the Messiah to show up in some high and mighty place, the Messiah instead comes among the lowest of places and among the lowliest of people. So rather than showing up amidst the noise and din and bright lights of our world, Jesus arrived in the quiet of night in a little-known place that no one ever would have thought to visit. Who would have ever thought to look for the Messiah in Bethlehem of all places? Well, no one really except those who had seen the power in their own lives be cut. Jesus was born among those people who'd seen the lights of their lives flipped off. And these were folks who were just sitting around in the dark, waiting around by candlelight, wondering if the power would ever come back on. Now, if you ever take a chance to read through Luke's gospel in a single sitting, you'll watch this cast of characters come across the stage. And first is Zechariah and Elizabeth. They're two simple peasants. They don't have two nickels to rub together. But they find that they're miraculously expecting a child, and they feel like they've just won the lottery. The next character that you find is John, who eventually grows up to be known as John the Baptist, or John the Baptizer. And John is this hillbilly preacher that no self-respecting church like this would ever hire. It's not so much that he just has that one single droning, monotone, one-point redundant sermon that he preaches each and every week, but it's that he's got all these grasshopper legs and dried honey stuck to his beard, and it scares the kids during the time with children. John is a nightmare for the good folks on the pastor-parish relations committee. Now, the next character that comes across the stage is Mary, and at first she looks like another knocked-up peasant teenager, another statistic, another drain on government resources. And then there's this mysterious boyfriend, Joseph, who swears for the life of him he has no idea how his girlfriend could possibly be pregnant. And then Luke adds in these nomadic homeless shepherds and some sort of barnyard animals and a roughshod stable in the back of some small inn. And what you find is a story that's completely absent of power. There are no high and mighty people here. There are no people of great importance. This is a story told for and about people who have no power. And Luke goes to great lengths to let us know that these are the folks who live each and every day of their lives in the shadows of life, where the places are where God's light never seems to quite fully reach. So according to Luke, the story of Jesus is about this transfer of power that's taking place, and that God is about to pull the plug on all of the powerful people who are ruling the world, because God is about to do a new thing. And so for those folks in candlelight who are living in the shadowed corners of life, wondering when the power's going to come on, this is about the new thing that God is doing to provide a light to guide them on their path. Now, the first six chapters that I read this morning are about this almost history lesson. It might sound a little bit like a civics lesson. And when that happens in the Bible, we tend to often want to skim it so we can get to the good stuff. But Luke has a reason for adding these people in by name. These are the most powerful people of the day. And so by naming them, Luke is saying, look at all these powerful people, because these are the exact ones that God is about to mess with. There's Tiberius, the emperor of Rome. He's been ruling for 15 years, and his reign is now about to come to a close. There's Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea. He has no idea what's waiting for him. There's Herod, the ruler of Galilee. His star is about to fade. Annas and Caiaphas, high priests of the temple, they'd better get down on their knees and pray. And so all of these people, Luke is saying, are about to be surprised at the new thing that God is doing. And Luke is telling this gospel story with a very wide-angle lens. He wants to give us this panoramic view of things that highlights those most important people of the day. That's why they are government officials and military leaders and heads of religious institutions. Because back in the day, these were the folks who were living in corrupted and co-opted and even coercive ways in their relationships with other people. And after making his point, Luke has the scene fade to black. And so we're left to wonder who or what is going to come that's going to make this situation right. And we know that whoever is going to come is going to be big. Now, we might imagine somebody like John Wayne riding into town on a horse, all set to set things right and enact justice. We might expect somebody like Rambo to show up to settle the score, to make the deceitful people pay for their selfish ways. But when the screen and the curtain is pulled open, we find it's John the Baptizer. He's standing there in the chilly waters of the Jordan River. His legs and knees are blue because it's so cold, and he's this odd but intimidating presence. He's all wrapped up in this camel hair coat long before Talbot's made it fashionable. And his hair is so matted and tangled that he looks like Tom Hanks's character in Castaway. And so you almost can't help but wonder, is this a joke, God? Is this really the best that you've got? Is this really how you're going to set things right in our world? But when John begins to preach, it becomes immediately clear that John is the right person for the job. And he roars like a lion. Repent, he cries out, turn your lives around. God is going to get to you one way or another, so you can either get in the water and get yourself cleaned up, or you can hang out on the shore and take your chances. But either way, you need to know, says John, God is coming. Now look at the people who came to the Jordan that day. These were folks who came to hear John preach. And they weren't just normal folks like you and me. These were the most powerful people of the day. The religious leaders of the temple showed up. They were the ones who claimed to know everything that there was about God. And they were the ones who sorted people into categories and boxes and said, you're in and you're out. And every day they told people exactly what God wanted and exactly what God thought. And that was the kind of deep power that they had. But the tax collectors, we're told, also came to the Jordan. And these were folks who could just show up completely unannounced, knock on your door, and demand that you pay your taxes immediately or face severe penalties. They were perhaps less like IRS government workers and a little bit more like loan sharks. They sort of had this Tony Soprano kind of power. But then we hear that the Roman soldiers come to hear John too. And these are the soldiers with their guns and their uniforms who never have to say please or thank you, because by their position, they were given extraordinary power. But these Roman soldiers came to hear this wild Jewish prophet preach. And so John looks out at the whole cast of them and begins his sermon by saying, who do you all think that you're kidding? The power that you have right now is not real power. There's one coming into the world who has a power that's greater than all of yours put together. Are you prepared to meet that one? And with just the beginning of that sermon, John pulls the plug on their sense of self-importance and power. Suddenly, these folks found themselves just like everybody else. These powerful people were now powerless. And that's when they asked John, so what do we do now? And John wrote each one of them a prescription. To the religious leaders, he said, get off your high horses. Stop using fear and guilt and shame to manipulate people. Start using your power for good. Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, do good things like that. And to the tax collectors, John said, stop padding the books and asking for people more than's actually due. Don't cheat them and leave them in deep need. And that's when the Roman soldiers said, hey, what about us? And John said, stop extorting other people. Quit the shakedowns and the blackmail. Stop parading around like the sense of force. From now on, start to use your power in peaceful ways. But that's when we come to the edge of the Jordan and we say, what about us, John? What about us here in Groton, Massachusetts? And John says that things honestly aren't quite right with all of us either. And John offers us each a prescription as well. Now, there are some of us here this morning, myself included, who have some measure of power in our lives. And there are some of us here this morning who probably have a lot less. And so wherever we happen to be on that sense of a spectrum, we know that there have always been times where we have used our power to get other people to do the things that we want. And sometimes we've even slipped over that line a little bit and done it in abusive and coercive ways. And if we're being honest, this has happened through the years, because this is the kind of thing we often pick up in our culture. But I think the biggest concern and the biggest challenge for each and every one of us is not so much that we take a power that we have and abuse it. I think the deeper problem is that we have power and we waste it. The truth is, we waste our power. We don't always use it for good. We don't always use it to heal. We don't use it to bring about justice. It just sits around untapped, sometimes unused, sometimes hidden and stored up. And so when we walk to the edge of the Jordan and John asks, and we ask John, what do we do? What should we do? We have to listen for that prescription that John gives us in our own personal lives. But we know that together as a church family, we're on the banks of the Jordan River together, and John gives us a prescription as well. Now, your church is standing at the threshold of something quite big. You're about to begin a capital campaign. And this is an opportunity to put your power to good use. Now, if you believe in the church's mission of sharing Christ and transforming lives as much as I believe you do, then this is an opportunity to put your power to good use together. See, together you have a power that can transform the lives of people in this area. You have a power that can remove obstacles and barriers. You have a power that can change the landscape of the town and the spiritual geography of the people who live in it. And the truth is not everyone has this kind of power. But you do. And together, you have a power to create this sense of legacy, of welcome and hospitality, of faith and of service, to make the world a more loving and just place. So I want to leave you with a story about a man who discovered what living a truly powerful life looks like. His name is Bob Goff, and at our Tuesday's Christian Ed meeting, I learned that a number of you had read his book this past year. Goff worked for a number of years as a very successful lawyer in California. And while doing some legal work in Uganda, the government asked him to stay and be one of their official legal lawyers for the country. And this thought of working with ambassadors and dignitaries made Goff very nervous. And so one night he asked his kids what they thought he should do whenever he met one of these dignitaries and ambassadors, one of these powerful world leaders. His youngest son said he should just invite them over for a sleepover. His daughter said he should ask them what they put their hope in. His oldest son said he'd love to make a little movie about each one and their answers. And Goff told his kids that these were all fabulous ideas and that if he ever met such a leader, he would put that into play. But sometime later, Goff came up with this better idea. Instead of waiting around to meet these leaders, why not invite them over for a sleepover? Why not ask them what they put their hope in and make a little movie of it? Now, his kids, of course, thought he was crazy, but Goff brought home piles of stationery. And they wrote together 1,200 personal letters to presidents and heads of state around the world. They mailed them off, and at first they heard nothing, but then one came back, and then a second. And in a matter of time, 29 world leaders agreed to be interviewed. So Goff pulled his kids out of school and flew around the world to meet these presidents and heads of state to have some milk and cookies together. And at the end of each one of these visits, the kids would give the leader a key. It was the key to their front door of their house so that leader could come for a sleepover. And through the years, Goff says, hundreds of world leaders have stayed with his family. And every time before the dignitaries head back home, everyone sits down at the kitchen table and they write out this very simple, informal peace treaty. It's a promise to make the world a better place. And it asks them to live sacrificially as much as they are able. And each dignitary signs that letter and takes a copy home to remind them of their promise. That's what the message of Christmas looks like. It's a subversive one. It's not about power over others, it's power with others. It's not about coercion, it's about solidarity. And there are people in our world who have power and who truly want to use it for good. But sometimes they need someone like John or a couple of creative kids to show them exactly how to do it. So remember that those who have power in our world often have a power that's even beyond themselves that can help transform the world. So this Advent, what will you do with your power? Thanks be to God.